This is an ABC podcast.
Tala for Lava and warm Pacific greetings. Welcome to Pacific Beat. I'm Talia Olatia. Today on the program, as internet speeds and connectivity are increased across the Pacific, new research finds that this greater internet access has parents worried about the safety of their kids online. You'll hear that story in less than 10 minutes. And Fijiana, the Fiji women's rugby team, has a new coach.
It's something new for me. I've been coaching the men for the last 11 years. The main reason why I decided to take this post, I just want to challenge myself. And also, it's a World Cup year next year, and I want to be the head coach of going into the first World Cup for the Fijiana.
Seni Serevakula is his name, and you'll hear more from him later in the program. But next, Malaita Province in the Solomon Islands has received a big funding injection from the US, and it's left experts questioning why.
You're listening to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
When it comes to donors in the Pacific, Australia is the dominant player. But the United States is too starting to make its move by doubling the amount of new funding it's bringing into the region to $200 million. And one of the biggest single allocations is $25 million earmarked for agriculture and environmental development in Malaita Province in the Solomon Islands. But the new funds come in the midst of a bitter spat between the province and the national government over Malaita's refusal to accept China as a diplomatic partner. And while the funding has been welcomed on the ground, Pacific experts are concerned geopolitics are at play, a claim, though, that's been soundly rejected by the US government. Reporter Evan Wasuka is in Honiara and has more.
The promise of $25 million comes at a time when Malaita's relations with the National Solomon Islands government is at an all-time low. The province had opposed Solomon Islands' diplomatic switch to China last year and continues to support Taiwan, which Beijing views as its own breakaway province. And last month, when hundreds took to the streets of Malaita's capital, Auki, to protest against the government, a sole American flag could be seen leading demonstrators. It was ridiculed by many on social media about the relevance of protesters using the flag, but its presence highlighted the geopolitics at play within the province. It saw Malaita's Premier Daniel Swidani call for an independence referendum after the government allowed a charter flight from China to bring back stranded nationals, as well as the new Chinese ambassador to Solomon Islands and foreign workers to build a new stadium. So the announcement of new US funding has come as a surprise to many people in Honiara, including government officials. But in Auki, Augustine Metti, a former NGO worker, says it is welcomed.
It's almost like 99% overjoy in the province, among the population, even the fairies. The people who haven't actually heard about it, but only heard it through word of mouth and so on, are all overjoyed.
Those sentiments were shared by the Malaita Premier, Daniel Swidani, who said in a statement,
"Nothing in such magnitude has ever been seen and felt by my people of Malaita Province since Solomon Islands gained independence in 1978. It is a great gift from a friend indeed."
The single pledge of $25 million is indeed a significant amount for the province that's Solomon Islands' largest. It's 50 times what Malaita received from all aid donors just 2 years ago, when it got just $500,000. So the new money has caught the attention of many aid watchers.
It does seem surprising, all the more so because in 2018, the United States only gave about $1.6 million to all of Solomon Islands. So it seems to be a remarkable increase in interest in the country and in particular in one province.
Dr. Terence Wood is a researcher with Australian National University's Development Policy Centre.
It's either a remarkable coincidence, for some reason someone in the US State Department has suddenly found Malaita on the map, or much more likely it's got a lot to do with geopolitics and to do with the stand that some at a provincial level in Malaita against China's involvement in Solomon Islands. So, yep, I'd almost certainly think that the United States is focusing on Melita right now because it sees Melita as a potential source of support in its own geostrategic struggle with China in the region.
And the Solomon Islands national government, too, is reading between the lines. In a statement, it said a detailed work plan had yet to be developed and approved by cabinet, and that
the national government wishes to caution certain groups and individuals within the country, especially the people of Melita province, to respect proper government processes and mechanisms in dealing with aid assistance. The government is aware of propaganda from various groups and individuals who are sharing inaccurate information on social media forums, which potentially has negative implications that are capable of misleading the public.
Dr. Terence Wood from ANU says the timing of the US funds is a concern, and this may heighten tensions between the province and the national government.
They really shouldn't be playing geopolitics in the countries of the Pacific, because there's always a risk that when you do this, you bring about some sort of harm to the people of the Pacific. Aid's meant to be about helping countries, and so the message that should be relayed loud and clear both to the United States and to other donors such as Australia, New Zealand and China, of course, is stop playing geopolitics with the Pacific. Focus on helping the people of the region.
But Chad Morris, who's the public affairs officer for the U.S. Embassy in Papua New Guinea that's also responsible for the Solomons, says that's not the case. He says the plans have been in the works for almost 2 years.
Like with many programs with the U.S. government, there is a fairly lengthy process to go through to evaluate those programs, to approve them. Certainly the timing of the announcement around the money and the money and the funding being approved is simply for us within the, you know, just the normal course of business. There's certainly not any intention to make this a political move.
Mr. Morris says the U.S. aid program has the blessing of both the Solomon Islands national and provincial governments and will run over the next 5 years. He says while Melita is the focus now, it could be expanded to other provinces.
We have the funding in place. We have the overall idea in place. And now we begin to work with development partners, implementation partners in Solomon Islands to really develop the actual activities that will comprise the program. While Bina Harbor and the Melita province are where the initial effort may be focused, we are then also looking at how to involve other provinces in Solomon Islands. This is not intended to be something focused only on Melita.
Back in Auki, Augustine Metti, a former NGO worker, believes the U.S. focus on agriculture and the environment is a good approach. He believes it'll bring development to a province that he says has long been neglected and could help persuade Melitans home from the island of Guadalcanal and the capital Honiara, where Melitan settlers were involved in the ethnic tension of the late 1990s and early 2000s.
So having something, an investment of this magnitude to try and encourage more people, especially those even on the island, to start getting some things done, might attract some who are out there not being useful to be able to also come back.
That was Augustine Metti, a former NGO worker in Melita province, ending that report from Evan Wasuka.
Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
Internet speeds and connectivity across the Pacific will be ramping up in a couple of years with the rollout of systems like the Coral Sea fibre optic cable. But there are new concerns the development could mean young people are at even more at risk from harmful content and cyber abuse. New research shows that parents are worried about the vulnerability of their kids due to greater internet access. And as Nick Fogarty reports, it comes in a region where online attacks are already rampant.
Fibre optic cable connections are set to transform the online world, and the Pacific is no exception. Among them is the Coral Sea cable, launched just a couple of months ago and connecting the Papua New Guinea and Solomon Islands capitals to Sydney via undersea cable. PNG's Communications and IT Minister Timothy Marciu says it will have a transformative effect.
It's everyone's knowledge that internet always improves people's lives, especially people who are using and doing business on the internet.
With global restrictions on travel and group gatherings during the COVID pandemic, fast, widespread online connectivity has become even more important But with it comes the heightened risk of cyberbullying and access to violent images, and children are especially vulnerable. Suzanne Legina is the CEO of the NGO Plan International Australia, which has just released a new study on these risks.
So our Online Safety in the Pacific report is really trying to map what sort of potential harms might come with the presentation of that kind of technology. And we looked at three countries, Solomon Islands, Kiribati and Papua New Guinea.
Workshops were completed with more than 200 children, parents, government and NGO workers, as well as police and community leaders across the three countries. While the participants were positive about the role of technology in strengthening social bonds, improving education and health access, and providing for entertainment and recreation, there was also a fear of harm, including from the children themselves. As one 14-year-old girl from Solomon Islands was quoted in the report,
Facebook is a problem because someone can send a bad picture to you and can hack your account and upload bad pictures onto your account.
There was also concern from parents, like this man in Kiribati.
I am worried about my daughter because she spent a lot of time using the internet. It is known now that she actually communicates with a married man online.
Suzanne Legina says girls were seen to be most at risk of online abuse.
And I guess the big takeaway for us was really that worry, I suppose, that already the Pacific is one of those places which is home to one of the highest rates of sexual and physical violence against women and girls anywhere in the world. And what would that technology bring in terms of the potential for that kind of abuse to continue in an online forum? And we're really trying to learn lessons from elsewhere in the region, especially within Asia, so that we can make sure that as this cable is rolled out and the technology arrives, we are building out the sort of social protection in a community that allows parents and children and teachers and governments to sort of wrap around what's necessary to keep children safe.
PNG's Communications Minister Timothy Marciu says his government is particularly concerned about the spread of child pornography and is aiming to push through legislation that will allow stronger governmental control over what's posted online.
We are working on a bill now so that we can change some laws to make the law stronger so that we can actually take this kind of posting, if they appear in our space, take them down, making sure that if we get anybody using this space to take them to court or put them in the hands of police.
Mr. Marciu says his government has also expressed its concern to Facebook, one of the most popular online platforms in the region. Several weeks ago, the social media giant began advertising for a Pacific market specialist, with the successful applicant required to speak a Pacific language and whose role will include moderation of online abuse. Sydney University online media expert Fiona Martin says while the job is a good start, whoever gets it will have an uphill battle.
What Facebook's relying on is users seeing instances of illegal or inappropriate speech and reporting them. So in small language groups, it's like a community effort to police Facebook. And I think in that respect, the market specialist, well, it's a great initiative and I'd like to see more people in those positions around the Pacific. It's only a drop in the bucket.
Fiona Martin also says that because most social media companies were formed in America and are grounded in its ideals of free speech, they can often be reluctant to interfere.
They don't want that free speech principle compromised. And it is quite difficult to persuade them to increase content regulation unless there is a public outcry. So I think it's most effective when you get a number of NGOs or civil society organisations together with government to lobby for changes.
That was Sydney University Associate Professor Fiona Martin there, and that report was by Nick Fogarty, and Facebook has also been contacted for comment.
Pacific Beat.
You're listening to Pacific Beat. I'm Talia Olatia. Still to come on the program, did you know that today is Global Hand Washing Day? And my goodness, hasn't 2020 truly been a year to wash your hands? WaterAid Australia will join the program live to talk about their hand washing projects in PNG in around 20 minutes' time. But coming up next, you'll get a weather report from Neville Coop from Nandraki Weather, and then Nick will join us to tell us about the stories making news today. But first, a little bit of music. This is John Mayer. He's waiting on the world to change.
One, two. That was John Mayer there with Waiting on the World to Change. I know that here in Melbourne, stuck in lockdown for as many months as we are definitely waiting for the world to change, but fingers crossed that may come sometime soon. Neville Coop is the director of Nandraki Weather and joins us now for a weather update. Good morning, Neville.
Hi, Talia.
And Neville, the weather's gone a bit crazy in the past 24 hours. What's been happening?
Yeah, look, we've seen this cloud band that's been sitting north of Fiji that's going to develop over the weekend into this weak tropical system to our south. That's gone a bit viral overnight and produced a whole heap of thunderstorms embedded in a broad cloud band. And that cloud band stretches basically from the Coral Sea, the southern islands of Solomon Islands and Milne Bay Province in PNG, across Vanuatu to Fiji, and then to Tongatapu and the southern islands. So it has become much more active, much more quickly than I had first anticipated. So there is quite a bit of weather out there. There's some heavy rain warnings and heavy rain alerts current for a number of islands in those regions. And we can expect some good falls over the next 24 to 48 hours, upwards of 20 millimetres or more, and some local flash flooding.
Mm. And will the weather stick around for the weekend as well?
Certainly will for some. Certainly for Fiji here and Tonga, and I suspect also for Vanuatu and probably also for Niue. The main areas that continue to stay dry are up near the equator, where there's literally been nothing now for many, many weeks, if not months. And also the mainland of Papua, the highlands are a bit dry now, I think, and also around Port Moresby. But there has been a bit of weather, as I mentioned earlier, about the eastern parts of PNG. So currently there's a weak front passing to the east of the Cooks, affecting parts of the French Polynesia group. That should move away pretty quickly.
Yeah, indeed. Neville, thank you so much for the update, and we'll talk again tomorrow.
Sure, no problem.
Thank you. That was Neville Coop there. He's the director of Nandraki Weather. And for weather updates at any time, you can always visit their Facebook page. Like I say, you'll find them at Nandraki Weather. Nandraki spelt N-A-D-R-A-K-I. Time now to find out the stories making news today, and I'm very excited because you're going to hear a new voice. Nick Zambulis is a uni student on placement here on with us on Pacific Beat, and I've really felt sorry for our interns because they're of course doing this during a global pandemic where they're not actually allowed to come into the office. And I remember when I was doing placement when I was a journalism student back at my uni days, like actually getting real life journalism experience was so important to me. So I thought, hey, why not get Nick to come and join us and do a live news wrap. So good morning, Nick, and welcome to Pacific Beat.
Good morning, Tali. It's great to be with you.
Indeed. Now, firstly, Nick, let's talk about the stories making news because Papua New Guinea has reported a rise in COVID-19 cases. What are the latest numbers?
Yeah, so there's 10 new COVID-19 cases that have been reported in the Eastern Highlands province of Papua New Guinea. And that brings the total number of infections in the country to just under 600 cases. Seven of the new cases are women, three are men, and the youngest case is a three-year-old child, while the oldest case is a 76-year-old man. So that the country's death toll is currently sitting at seven.
Yeah, it has been such an increase with Papua New Guinea. It has a few cases every day. And then, of course, yesterday being 10, bringing the number of infections to 575. It is obviously something that Papua New Guinea is still working on to try and contain the spread of COVID-19 in the country. And coming up later in the program, because it is Global Handwashing Day, we're going to talk to WaterAid Australia, who are running projects across Papua New Guinea to ensure that they have running water and soap to ensure that they can do the, you know, the things that we're supposed to do, like washing our hands, because it is so important during this global pandemic. I don't know about you, Nick, but I feel like I've just gone through so much hand sanitizer and soap this year. It's kind of been a little bit insane.
Yeah, it's crazy. My hands are actually just getting sore now from just constantly washing them. It's full on.
Yeah, it's a bit dry, feeling like calluses might start coming in, but at least you're not getting the viruses. That's what I keep telling myself as I grab for the hand sanitizer. Now, staying in Papua New Guinea, there's been some new developments with Papua New Guinea's biggest drug bust from late July. What's been happening?
Yeah, so you might remember this case. It was the biggest drug smuggling case out of Papua New Guinea. That basically there was 500 kilos of cocaine that drug smugglers were trying to bring into Australia, but the plane was so loaded with drugs that it actually crashed while trying to take off outside of Port Moresby. The new charges that have been laid are on the pilot, John David Cutmore, who's expected to appear before the Central District Court on Friday. Cutmore and his accomplices, yacht captain John Datanasio, and three Papua New Guineans were charged for their alleged involvement in smuggling drugs into Australia. So the charges that he'll be facing are under the Papua New Guinea Customs Act, Money Laundering and Finance Act. So there's quite a bit going on there.
Indeed. And we'll keep people updated here on ABC Radio Australia. I do remember that story from July, and it was kind of insane that the reason why we even knew about what had happened is because the plane had been so filled with drugs, it was actually too heavy to take off and crashed. And that's what alerted it. So it's like, also, maybe a lesson in greed. So be like, you know,
not
that I'm saying smuggle drugs across country borders, but if you do, just make sure that your plane can handle it. Also, don't. Just, okay, I take everything back. Just don't smuggle drugs. You didn't hear it here first. Also, greed is bad. Like, let's say that. Also, other things are bad too. Let's talk about something that is good. Well, good from bad, because there is an island in Brazil that sounds impossibly perfect. If you picked up my cat puns there, you'll know it's about cats. But Nick, tell me more.
Yeah, unfortunately, this story has a bit of a sad point to it. Off the coast of Mangaratiba in Brazil, there is an island, and this island is called the Island of the Cats. Well, the real name of the island is actually Furtada Island. And 250 cats live here. It's a pretty cool story, actually. So just 20 years ago, there were two cats on the island, and it's since grown to this paradise of felines, I guess you could say. Fishermen would leave scraps to feed the cats, and it actually gained a huge tourist following. People would go to this island just to see all the cats and leave them food and water. But a few months ago, after COVID really got into full swing, fishermen reported to the locals in Mangaratiba that there was a problem. Without the tourists, the cats were actually starving. So local volunteers have started installing some food and water dispensers, and they're now making weekly trips to restock them to make sure the cats have something to eat.
Well, it looks like those cats have got more than 9 lives, thanks to the generosity of those volunteers. But it is such an amazing story that there could be an island of cats. I'm personally a dog lover, and so when I saw this story, I was like, no one would ever abandon dogs on an island. And then I was like, wait, that's mean to cat lovers, because I know that, Nick, you like cats. So
I do. And, you know, I'm really tempted now to make a trip to Brazil when this is all over, just to visit these cute little cats.
Just make sure that you've got some food and water with you when you do visit.
Yeah, that's right.
Indeed. Well, Nick, thank you so much for joining Pacific Beat and for bringing us the stories making news. Hopefully that wasn't too painful for you.
No, it's been an absolute pleasure. I've loved it. Thanks for having me.
Thanks, Nick. That was Nick Zambulis. He's a uni student on placement here with us on Pacific Beat, and he has been bringing you the stories making news today.
Pacific Beat.
You're listening to Pacific Beat with me, Talia Olatia. Still to come on the program, you'll meet the new coach of the Fiji women's rugby team, Seni Seravakula. The Fijiana will make their debut on the World Cup stage in New Zealand next year. So his appointments come at a very critical time. You'll hear more about it in around 20 minutes. But speaking of New Zealand, they head to the polls this weekend, and you'll hear from two members fighting for re-election.
Tune in to Radio Australia this Sunday as we bring you the 2020 Bledisloe Cup.
To Sopawanga, his pass is intercepted and a breakaway try for the Wallabies.
Will the All Blacks retain the Bledisloe Cup for another year, or will the Wallabies rise up and defeat the world's number one team?
Luffy gets the pass inside and Hodges away. Hodges over the 22 and the Wallabies will get the opening try of the game.
Sunday, 12:30 PNG time on Radio Australia.
New Zealanders vote in a general election this weekend, and for the second time in the country's history, the two major parties are headed by women. One of them is something of a global celebrity, Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern, whose response to the Christchurch terrorist attacks and the COVID-19 crisis has won her praise at home and overseas. The other is a quite a different prospect, Judith Collins, a tough-talking political veteran who's been compared with the former UK PM Margaret Thatcher and has faced allegations that she was trying to exploit her Samoan husband's ethnicity for electoral gain. Barbara Miller's been talking to the woman, hoping to unseat Jacinda Ardern.
New Zealand is back out of lockdown and Judith Collins is travelling the length and breadth of the country.
You're in Christchurch today, yes, I heard.
That's right. I've been in Christchurch all day now at the airport and going back to Auckland.
She faces the Herculean task of trying to unseat Jacinda Ardern, whose Labour Party is polling so well it might be able to govern without a coalition partner, despite the country's proportional representation system.
They wrongly called the election for Bill Shorten. When Scott Morrison won, they wrongly called in the UK, said, you know, that Boris Johnson wouldn't win. They said that Brexit wouldn't happen. Actually, do you know what? The polls are most often wrong these days.
The 61-year-old National Party leader is also known as Crusher Collins, a reference to the time when, as police minister, she backed crushing the cars of troublesome hoons.
Well, Barbara, it's not one I've ever used myself, but I've had this nickname now for 10 years. And, you know, there are worse names. Nobody ever says that I'm, you know, wimpy, incapable of making decisions, indecisive, or any of those things. So at least, you know, over the years, most people have understood that possibly there are times when the name works.
Now, what about the comparison to Margaret Thatcher? Is that fair?
Well, I tell you what, she certainly got stuff done.
Now, Jacinda Ardern, when she came to power, she promised a leadership full of kindness, compassion and carbon neutrality. What sort of New Zealand would we have under your leadership?
Well, we'd build the roads, we'd build the hospitals, we'd build the schools. We wouldn't just say, you know, look, it's okay just to wish for things. We would get them done.
Collins is a politician from an earlier generation used to attack mode. That's not playing well amongst significant sections of the population at the moment.
Richard Shaw is Professor of Politics at Massey University.
It's difficult being the change candidate in this particular election when what people are very clearly wanting is continuity and stability and not change. This is not one of those historical moments where you can sense a public mood for change in the air.
Judith Collins only took over the helm of her troubled party in July, the third leader this year. Her campaign has been marred by a few hiccups, including a leaked email from a disgruntled colleague and allegations that she was trying to exploit her husband's ethnicity for electoral gain. Dr. Somer Kapitan, a senior lecturer in marketing at Auckland University of Technology, says despite it all, she's been doing pretty well in the televised debates with Jacinda Ardern.
Judith will tell it like it is, and that's been kind of good for her image. She holds herself well, she's competent, she's clear, she's decisive, she's a little bit the crusher, but still respectful, right? She draws the line. She's not gonna rip Labour a new one. She's not gonna rip into the party leader, but she is gonna say, no, this is how this policy actually went down.
But if the polls are correct, Jacinda Ardern is set for re-election, and the National Party could be looking for yet another leader before the year's out.
That was Barbara Miller there on New Zealand's Leader of the Opposition, Judith Collins. Meanwhile, the veteran Kiwi politician Winston Peters is fighting for his political survival this weekend. He was the kingmaker who catapulted Jacinda Ardern into the top job, but things aren't looking good for the 75-year-old foreign minister. But he's told the ABC the polls have it all wrong. Here's Barbara Miller again.
always colourful and controversial, he's one of the few Kiwi politicians with name recognition across the Tasman. Winston Peters has been a force in New Zealand politics for decades.
New Zealanders need a fail-safe vote based on proven experience and common sense.
He's described his role as junior coalition partner with Jacinda Ardern's government as a handbrake on silly ideas. But as the election looms, Winston Peters seems keen to emphasise how much the Labour New Zealand First government has got done.
We, through some serious crises, including COVID-19 and, of course, the Christchurch massacre, have had seriously stable government. And we've passed 190 pieces of legislation, which means we, in the main, agreed. Of course, there were strong debate on other matters, but that's the nature of politics.
Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern's star has risen so much that it's easy to forget that although support for Labour surged when she took over the party leadership in 2017, they still came in well below the centre-right National Party. It was Winston Peters' decision to form a pact with Labour that allowed the then 37-year-old to lead her country.
Well, look, we took not a risk, we took a calculated judgment at the time when everybody said, well, she hasn't got the experience in this, and well, you know, all the complaints they make, particularly where women are concerned. And we said, well, you can say that, but we believe she's got what it takes. And we've been proven to be right.
I know that you traditionally kind of dismiss the polls, but they're really not looking good for you this time around, are they? They've got you just on a couple of percent. What makes you think that when it comes round to Saturday, you're going to be able to bring that up to 5%, which is the threshold in New Zealand to get into Parliament?
Well, because that statement's wrong, like it was wrong in the last Australian election, like it was wrong in the UK Brexit election, and like it was wrong in America. My point is that we've come from far worse than this to storm home on election day, and there's a surge on, and I'm very confident of the outcome.
Analysts think the Deputy Prime Minister's confidence is misplaced.
I'm probably at the point that I bet money against them.
Dr. Lara Greaves is a lecturer in New Zealand politics at the University of Auckland.
It's one of those things in New Zealand politics, it's almost like an old trope that you never write off Winston Peters. But I think a lot of us, a lot of commentators are now willing to kind of call it and say that they're not going to get back in.
Record numbers of New Zealanders have already cast their ballots in advance voting. But Winston Peters says he'll fight till the last minute to try and convince those still to do so or the undecided to back him.
You can't afford to think about being tired. The election will be over. For us, that's 6 p.m. on the 16th. Plenty of time to have a long sleep then. We're leaving it, to use a famous Aussie rugby or league term, all on the paddock.
That was New Zealand's Deputy Prime Minister and Minister for Foreign Affairs, Winston Peters, there talking to Barbara Miller. And of course, New Zealand goes to the polls this weekend on Saturday, the 17th of October. You're listening to Pacific Beat. I'm Tully Rollett-Tia. Next, we'll find out what WaterAid Australia has planned for today. It is, of course, Global Handwashing Day. But some music before that. This is Pacific Soul with Musika Malie.
Musika Malie. My sima,
That was Pacific Soul there with Musika Malie, a song that many Samoans like to siva Samoa to. And fun fact, when my cousin Sina first taught me how to siva Samoa, the first move that she taught me was the hand washing action with my graceful hands. A lot of Samoans will know what I'm talking about. And when it comes to hand washing, 2020 has truly been a year for it. Today is Global Hand Washing Day. And the reality is that even during a pandemic where we're encouraged to wash our hands, many people around the world don't have access to running water for basic necessities like hand washing. In fact, WaterAid says 785 million people in the world don't. That's one in 10. And in Papua New Guinea, where they've seen frequent water cuts and water rationing, this is definitely the case. Tom Muller is the Director of Policy and Programs at WaterAid Australia, who's been working in PNG on projects that include teaching people how to make their own soap for hand washing. He joins us now. Good morning, Tom, and welcome to Pacific Beat.
Good morning, and thanks a lot for having me on.
Now, today is Global Hand Washing Day, but especially this year, just how important is hand washing?
Look, it's never been more important. And, you know, I mean, 2020, the year of a pandemic, and we know that one of the first line of defence for ordinary people and everybody is hand washing. And, you know, we take it for granted that you get up in the morning, you go to the bathroom and there's running water and there's soap, and it's a really easy action to just wash your hands and maintain good hygiene practices. But for so many people globally, as you just said, you know, one in 10, they don't have access to the water they need or the soap or the hand washing facility. Mm-hmm. And as you said, in PNG, the numbers are even greater who are lacking the access they really need. So it really is central. And, you know, one of the most amazing things about the work we've been doing is just seeing the motivation, the energy, and just the drive that people have had to really build hand washing facilities quickly and to really take on the messaging and adapt to the need to make hand washing a priority.
It's such a simple and basic necessity. So what are some of the challenges that you face when you're trying to implement, you know, as you say, taps, hand washing, soap, all those kind of things that create such a disparity around the world for those who don't have easy access like we do here in Australia?
I mean, you know, there are lots of different barriers, some of which have to do with the access to water, whether or not there's a water point that's accessible nearby. You know, I was reading some stories from PNG, you know, recently of, you know, women in rural areas who have to go 2 to 3 hours to collect water. And when you do have seasonal dry periods, that can be longer. So there's a real barrier just to actually accessing the water. You know, there's a barrier in terms of actually the cost of soap, and there's a barrier in terms of having the facilities there that you can maintain and keep functional all the time. And so I guess what we've tried to do in the different countries where we work is find simple, practical solutions that people can build and maintain themselves and use regularly.
Tell me about some of those simple and practical solutions that you've come up with, because some of them, like the tippy taps, are quite ingenious.
Yeah, look, I mean, the tippy tap is used in lots of parts of the world, and it's a really simple solution. And really, it's a bucket or a container using a foot pedal and some rope. And, you know, you have the water coming into the container, and you use the foot pedal to tip the water and wash your hands. And it's incredibly hygienic in that the only thing that a child or a woman or a man will touch when they're using the tippy tap is the soap. So you touch, you know, you use the foot pedal, you pour the water, and it's an incredibly easy solution. So we've been working with partners across PNG to just roll out, the ways of which to build tippy taps really quickly. But in other parts of the world where we work, we've had colleagues do amazing things. I mean, in WaterAid India, they've adapted rickshaws so that you have mobile hand washing stations. You know, in Zambia, they've thought through how do you actually turn hand washing facilities into accessible hand washing facilities so that somebody with a disability that is in a wheelchair that needs to access it and can access it hygienically can do so. So, I mean, we've just seen people across the countries where we work come up with lots of really practical, easy solutions.
And life-saving solutions as well. You're listening to Tom Muller. He's the Director of Policy and Programs at WaterAid Australia. I'm talking about today being Global Handwashing Day and just how important it is to have access to simple and basic things that I know I take for granted here in Melbourne, and that is running water and access to soap. And as you were saying about the tippy taps, you could see the difference that that would make in PNG with lots of remote villages and even settlements that don't have water taps. Another project that you've done that I'm very interested in is that you've been teaching people in PNG how to make their own soap. Why is this important, and also what's the recipe?
Well, I mean, it's fundamental for the reasons that you can't prevent the spread of a virus unless you're washing your hands with soap. So as you're saying, it's about saving lives and, you know, supporting the livelihoods of individuals. So yeah, we work with a group called ESCOW, the ECP Council of Women, which is a body that represents 20,000 PNG women up in ECP. We, you know, are working with them on a larger water sanitation hygiene project, and they provide their knowledge and their expertise and help us make sure the work we do is really taking on issues around gender and power and safety. But with the impact of COVID and the impact that that's had on the informal markets and on economic activity, we did see an opportunity to work with ESCOW to actually produce soap locally and for different women's groups to be able to sell soap in the markets, which is really critical when, you know, 75% of people working in the informal markets are women, and it's such a, you know, essential necessity soap. It's one that they can make easily and sell. There's a, you know, there's a demand there with all the messaging and focus on the importance of soap and hand washing. So yeah, we've been working with ESCOW to look at how do you make soap, what products you can use, what kind of business model do they need. And I think what I'd say about that is it's not only then about the hand hygiene, it is about trying to create a longer term income generating opportunity for ESCOW and to help strengthen them as a body that represents PNG women in the ECPIC.
Absolutely. And like homemade face masks, homemade soap, are there any like concerns that you have to make sure that it is going to actually sanitise and be hygienic? Is there the same degree to that as like soap you'd buy at a store?
Look, I mean, you know, the women in ECPIC have been making soap for a long time, you know, using coconuts in input you can put into it. You do need to have other inputs, but yes, you do need to make sure you're making effective soap. But it's something that they've been doing for a long time. So I wouldn't say so much we've been teaching. I'd say more that we've been actually supporting their ability to do it anyway, and providing startup kits for more women, and supporting the ESCOW women to work with other members to actually spread the capacity amongst those 20,000 members, and to give them an income generating activity at this time when there's real economic pressures across PNG.
Yeah, indeed. Finally, Tom, how will you be celebrating Global Handwashing Day? Will you be washing your hands a little bit more frequently, or just being appreciative when you do?
I don't know. It's been a funny old year, and you know, there's been lots of hand washing. So I guess I'll keep doing it. I encourage everybody to do it. It really is the most simple thing we need to get on and do. But it's a real challenge in many countries where you just don't have access to water and you don't have access to soap. So I'd encourage everyone to go out there and just remind everybody that you know about the 40% of the people globally that actually don't have access to water and soap and the hand washing facilities, and to think about what simple steps you could take to support the message around Global Hand Washing Day.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Tom, thank you so much for your time and for your tips, and have a good Global Hand Washing Day.
You too. Thanks a lot.
Thank you. That was Tom Muller, the Director of Policy and Programs at WaterAid Australia, speaking to me there. Today, of course, is Global Hand Washing Day, which makes sense. Why not play this promo?
Washing your hands is very important to keep you and your family safe from coronavirus. Wash your hands with clean water and soap for at least 20 seconds, as often as you can, throughout the day. Do it before touching your face, preparing food or eating. Wash your hands after you have used the toilet, after being in a public area such as a market, and after having physical contact with people who might be unwell. Washing your hands regularly will keep you and your family safe.
It's such a simple and basic thing to do, but I think 2020 has taught us just how important hand washing is and to ensure that you are washing your hands for 20 seconds. I feel that now when I go to a public bathroom, I like literally listen to the running water and I'm like, yep, that person's washed her hands for 20 seconds. Things that you become aware of in 2020. You're listening to Pacific Beat with me, Talia Olatia. Now, the man who led the Fijian Endrua to the Australian Rugby Championships 2 years ago has now accepted an offer to coach Fijiana, the national women's team. Seni Serovakula was chosen for the job by the Fiji Rugby Union Board, and he takes on the role at a critical time with the team preparing to make their debut on the biggest stage of all in New Zealand next September. And speaking to Richard Hewitt, Seni Serovakula says that's what attracted him to the job in the first place.
It's something new for me. I've been coaching the men for the last 11 years. Main reason why I decided to take this post, I just want to challenge myself. And also, it's a World Cup year next year, and I want to be the head coach of going into the first World Cup for the Fijiana.
So in terms of making the transition from, as you say, a number of years coaching men's teams to coaching the national women's team, I mean, how much learning will you have to do now?
It's going to be a tough job, the way that I'm going to be communicating to the girls. And it will be a learning experience also, but I'm very excited. But it is going to be a tough job to start knowing the players. But I've been telling, IDing them for a couple months ago. As soon as I apply for the job, I will start telling ID and going around the country.
Now, I would presume that one of the advantages that you have compared to many other rugby-playing countries at the moment is you do have rugby action in Fiji, and I'm presuming most, if not all, of your Fijiana squad will be available for training and coaching from now.
Certainly, we have a very strong competition here in Fiji. We got two more rounds before the semi-final. And also one of the reason I also took up this job that we've got the Fiji Rugby Academy for the women. So that's 30 girls been contracted by World Rugby, and it was launched last 2 months.
So I'm guessing, therefore, the difficult bit for you as coach between now and the World Cup is finding international competition, because over the next few months, it's likely there isn't going to be any.
That's really true. For especially in this year, 2020, there will be no matches. But surely we're going to draw up some plan to have a local competition here, like a franchise or state of origin for the women after the final. But surely there will be no international competition for this year.
So given that you have the players there and you can work with them from now, but there is this problem in terms of finding build-up international matches, what sort of expectations do you have for the team?
There's too many focus for these girls is to keep them fit and to lift up their skill level. But at the same time, it's said, as a coach, there will be no competitive competition to go to, like the Oceania 15s or playing against Australia or New Zealand. But we'll just try and live with what we have here in Fiji.
And just harking back to your time as coach with the Fijian Endrua, I mean, there is talk now that possibly that side could yet become a super rugby franchise, possibly in New Zealand or maybe currently more likely in Australia. Has that thought been at the back of your mind, that if you'd stayed with the Endrua, who of course are essentially in hiatus at the moment, that you could have been coaching a super rugby franchise in a year or two's time?
Keeping my finger crossed, if that goes through, it will be in 2022. But I've got a one-year contract with Fijiana. It finishes on the 31st of December next year, 2021. Hopefully, if that competition pop up and draw into the Super Rugby, I'll surely be applying. I believe that I would be the right person to get that job again.
That was Seni Serovakula, the newly appointed coach of the Fiji Rugby's National Women's 15, the Fijiana, and he was talking there to Richard Hewitt. Oh, sport. I feel like I'll be very excited next year to watch the Fijiana in New Zealand at the World Cup in September and just all the sporting times till then. But if you haven't caught our new Can You Be More Pacific show that launched last Thursday, you can listen to it again tonight for their next show. If you need a reminder, here's the promo.
Love sport? Join Rock and Cav every Thursday night across the Pacific
for
Can you be more Pacific?
Each week, they'll have their own unique take on all things sport.
Ratu Ngolea, what a legend. I'm so proud of that young man.
That guy is on his way to being at the same status as Nick Maitanui, I reckon.
That's a big call.
Right. I'm calling it, man.
Thursday nights across the Pacific.
With Sonny Bill, you also get the aura around Sonny Bill.
You know what? That aura you speak of. Yes. Brings the best out of players.
They see a guy that they've looked up to.
And that's their whole life. Difference between Benji Marshall.
Yes.
See, we just unlocked the vault right
now. We ask questions and then we answer them later.
Exactly. That's it, ladies and gentlemen. We've just unlocked
the NRL Da Vinci Code. Rock and Cav, unlocking codes.
Can you be more Pacific? 6 p.m. Thursday nights, PNG time on Radio Australia.
That's right. You can catch the boys tonight at 6 p.m. PNG time. And you can also catch Richard Ewart on the afternoon edition of Pacific Beat from 3 p.m. PNG time. So keep listening to your radio on ABC Radio Australia, preferably. And you can keep getting news and information throughout the day. And you can also follow and like us on the ABC Radio Australia Facebook page and join the many conversations that are taking place there. And also, if you want to listen back to any stories of today, just head on over to our website. ABC Pacific Beat is where you'll find us, and you can listen to us whenever you like. Literally, you can just listen to our voice all day if you want to. I'm not going to judge you. I'm Talia Olatia. I'll catch you at the same time tomorrow morning. Have a good Thursday. Fafatai le fa longu longu.